God promised Abraham that he would give his descendants a what?
Land.
Give them land. The land of Canaan, specifically. They didn't get there right away, did they? It was a long time, of course, before they actually entered into the promised land. When they first entered into the promised land and they settled down in there, they were first ruled by men, in one case a woman, ruled by who? By judge. And I think there were about 15 of them in all. And who was the last judge?
Samuel
was the last judge. Well, as Samuel was getting old and people came to him and said, look, you're old, your sons do not walk in your ways. We need something else besides what we've had all this time. What did they ask for? They asked for a king. There in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 6, give us a king to judge us. You remember some of the specific reasons they gave for wanting a king?
Want
to be like all the other nations? In many ways, they accomplished that. Not in a good way. But Jim, do you have something? Yeah, I'm thinking of one other very specific thing.
Lead them in the battle.
Lead them in the battle. Yeah, someone to go out before them to lead them in the battle. And that was important because up to this point, they had never been successful in battle without King. Right? God wasn't really all that thrilled with this request, was he? Samuel took it personally. God wouldn't say to him, this is not a rejection of you, it's a rejection of me. Nevertheless, he granted them a king, right? And the first king was Saul, right? So that leads us into the period that we just got through studying, the United Kingdom, which lasted for 120 years. And Saul had reigned for 40 years. He was followed by David for 40 years, and then Solomon. 40 years. And of course, we need to really hone in on David because there was an important covenant made with him. His house was going to endure, right? And so, as we get into the divided kingdom and we study these kings of Judah, they're all going to be descendants of who? Of David, right? The line's going to change some there in Israel, right? The line's not going to change in you. It will be one descendant after another of David. All right, so let's go back into chapter 11 for just a moment from last week, and let's kind of set up what we're studying tonight. God told Solomon, after your death, when your son is reigning, I will tear the kingdom away from him and give it to another. And he even described this one he would give it to as your servant, and that's literally what Jeroboam was. He was an officer there in Solomon's kingdom. But I will tear the kingdom away from him and give it to another. I will, however, give him one tribe for the sake of David and Jerusalem. Ahijah the prophet told Jeroboam he would be given 10 tribes to rule over and promised him that his house would endure if he was faithful. And so when Solomon's son takes over, the kingdom is going to be torn away from him and given to Jeroboam. Now, Solomon's son will have that one tribe that he'll be able to rule over, but the other 10 will be torn away from him. Now, I want you to pause for just a minute. Please remember this promise that God made to Jeroboam, because I believe it's a huge factor in some of the things that we'll look at here in just a moment. Jeroboam, your line will continue. Your house will continue if you remain faithful to me. So we're going to come back to that. I just wanted to make sure that sticks in our mind. Solomon, of course, somehow or another heard about all of this, and he tried to kill Jeroboam. So Jeroboam fled to Egypt until Solomon was dead. Of course, that brings us to the end of chapter 11. So, already in chapter 11, we're anticipating no longer a united kingdom, but a what? A divided kingdom. That's what we're about to have. Now, as far as time period of this, it's right now we're somewhere around 921 B.C., and this period is going to take us to 721 B.C. And so this period of the divided kingdom is going to last about 200 years. All right, so it's going to be divided up now into two kingdoms. First of all, there's the kingdom of Judah. And really, when Solomon's son, Rehoboam, takes over, I guess you can say technically, for a very brief time, that it was still a united kingdom. Right? Solomon is over the entire nation of Israel. Rehoboam reigned for 17 years, but one of the significant things I want to point out, and I think this also factors into the discussion tonight, Rehoboam was 41 years old. So when we look at some of how Rehoboam conducted his business, let's go attribute that to youthful indiscretion. He was 41 years old. He was old enough to know that. So I just wanted to point that out. And then, of course, the other kingdom, the kingdom to the north, will be Israel. And the first king there, of course, will be Jeroboam. I don't believe anywhere it tells us. I'll look for So we're going to be looking some at both of them tonight, primarily Jeroboam. All right, so you've got no longer this entire area of Israel under one kingdom. Now you've got the little smaller kingdom to the south called Judah, and the larger kingdom to the north called Israel. So as we keep studying through here, we're going to see references to each one of these kingdoms. All right, so let's just kind of go through each chapter. Reading that you had for tonight from 2 Chronicles is essentially the same. There's not a whole lot added there. But we're just going to kind of go through. I'm going to have some questions up here. Some of them may be like the ones you got. Most of them will not. But hopefully this will kind of take us through the material and hopefully provoke a little thought and discussion. First of all Israel went to what city? What city would you expect for this to take place in? It would take place in Jerusalem. And I really don't know why they went to Shechem. Now, I do know this. Shechem has great significance in the history of Israel. We refer to that promise. God made Abraham there just as well. His descendants will be given on him. Guess where Abraham was? He was in Shechem. In Joshua chapter 8, toward the end of that chapter, as they come to Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and the blessings and cursings are announced upon the people, blessings if they obey, curses if they disobey, guess where they are? Guess where Shechem was situated? Between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. So, great significance to the city of Shechem as far as this land was concerned. Now, did that have anything to do with it? I don't know. What I do find significant is when Jeroboam becomes king over Israel, the northern kingdom, where does he first establish his presence? 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 25, built Shechem and resided there. And so, I don't know exactly what all took place there, but it's like, here's Rehoboam going to the city of Shechem to be installed as the king, and there's this rebellion against him. Jeroboam becomes king of Israel, and where does he first set up his residence? So a little bit of, maybe a little bit of tit for tat there. I'm not sure what all was going on behind the scenes. So, he's got all Israel coming together to him there in Shechem to make him king, but it doesn't go quite as smoothly, right, as Rehoboam would hope. Jeroboam and his fellow Israelites were specifically told that Jeroboam Jeroboam and his fellow Israelites spoke to Rehoboam and made what request? What was it like from Rehoboam? Lighten the burdens, right? Who they put burdens on them? Solomon they put burdens on them, right? You need to make it easier on your servants. You need to speak more kindly to them. You need to take a little bit of the yoke off of them. did he consult in the meantime? Who did he go to first? Yeah, he went to the older men, to the elders, and they advised what?
Make it harder. Make it harder.
No, not the elders.
The elders?
Yeah, the elders didn't make it lighter.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. We'll get to the heavy guys.
Yeah, you're right.
But no, the elders said, do as they ask. And they will be your servants. They'll be glad to submit to you. You'll do as you ask. But then he went to the younger guys, right? And their advice was not exactly like what the elders. In fact, if you had to characterize the advice of the young people in relation to the old people, what would you say about it? It was as polar opposite as something could possibly be. Let's see if we can read just a little bit of that. Verse 10 says, then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, thus you should speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, but you shall make it lighter on us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's legs. And now, whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with spurs. Now, you may remember from our previous study, we've been hinting all along at how there was some unrest kind of simmering there among the people. And we talked about all the different building projects, and more people were involved in serving the king. And things might have looked one way, but there were some problems there, right? And now we're beginning to get a little bit more insight into what that was about.
Well, it's notable, too, that he did not consult him. He didn't ask God.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. One thing we need to get that one. Yeah, we're going to talk about counselors here in a little bit, and maybe this is a good time to bring it up. Proverbs, you go to the book of Proverbs, there's a lot said about seeking wise counsel. But the safest counselor of all is the Lord. And really, even when you seek counsel from other people, doesn't the motive behind it mean everything in the world? In other words, if you're going to seek counsel, and you're just looking for people who will tell you what you want to hear, that's not going to turn out very well, right? You're looking for people who will help you better understand God's will, help you maybe better understand how to apply something in God's will. But you're looking for the truth, right? Whether it hurts or not. Okay? Whether it agrees with your current position or not. That's what you're looking for. So it makes all the difference in the world as far as counsel is concerned. But thank you for that point, Jim. Alright, so whose advice would he heed? Listen to the young bucks, didn't you? Right. And look, go on and on about this. I won't spend much time with this. But generally speaking, it turns out better when you listen to the older folks over the young folks. That doesn't mean that younger people don't have something, very valuable to offer. And it doesn't mean that with wisdom always comes age. There are some older people who don't have a little bit of wisdom. But we're just talking in general terms. Yeah, in thinking about that wording, and that may be, we need maybe just take that on face value, man. One of the thoughts that did occur to me, though, is maybe that's just anticipating, what ultimately takes place. He might have worded that way, but I'm not sure on that. But he may have just decided, kind of in line with what we were just saying, I'd say, no, that's not what I'm putting here. So you may have a good point there. All right, so this turn of events, this Rehoboam not giving heed to what the people of Israel had said about Lot and Gerz, this whole turn of events was for him. In chapter 12 and verse 15, certainly a significant verse in understanding all of this. So the king did not listen to the people. The turn of events was from the Lord, that he might fulfill his word, which the Lord has spoken to your tents. Oh, good, good, good. You just have your kingdom, right? Do what you want to do with it, but bring on. And so the rebellion has begun, right? And, this is going, of course, lead to the establishment of this other kingdom, and they're going to install Jeroboam. All right, so Rehoboam's next brilliant plan. Who did he send to the people? He picked probably the absolute best guy he could have, right? Who did he send? Noah. What was Noah done?
Majority of the text.
Yeah. You think that might have been based on everything that's been said, and even maybe what we studied in previous weeks? Might have been a little bit of a sore subject. Yeah. I don't know if he was the worst one. They could have been conceived, but I think there are probably a whole lot of them that would do that. And I don't know, it doesn't explicitly tell us why, but I assume maybe it had something to do with quelling this rebellion and getting things back in order. I don't know. But it didn't last long, because what did they do to him? They stoned him. Since they stoned him with stone. A little bit
behind
that. Yeah, good. That's right. When Jeroboam is made king over Israel, what does Rehoboam then decide to do to restore the kingdom? He's got another plan to get things back in order, right? Another war. Yes, sir. He assembled the house of Judah with what other tribe? The tribe of Benjamin. So we're learning a little bit more now. There will be more said in the next several weeks as we study, but not only is there the tribe of Judah making up that kingdom, but Benjamin has remained loyal as well. And so let's keep that in mind. Check.
Perhaps even further to the point of Rehoboam's fault through all this and not thinking things through, Jesus talked about a man who goes to war without counting to see if he's got to be in the fight.
Yeah, and of course, no matter what his plans were, how would he stop in his tracks? What stopped him from going to war?
Word of God came to him in mind.
Yeah, word of God came through this prophet and said, you, and this, again, this wouldn't be too hard to misunderstand. You shall not go up, nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel, that every man return to his house. Here we see that phrase again, at least akin to what we saw before, for this thing is from him. And to their credit, it says, therefore they obeyed the word of the Lord and turned back according to the word of the Lord. Alright, so Jeroboam is now king over Israel. This attempt to, restore the kingdom to Rehoboam through war, this attempt to kind of reconcile things through this menorah or whatever, all that's failed. He's firmly established now. But what does Jeroboam now become concerned about? What did he say in his heart? Trying to lose it. What's going to take place that would cause him specific concern about that? Where are the people, at least if they're obedient to the law, where are they going to be going to? We go back down to Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem was part of that southern kingdom, right? That Rehoboam was over. They're going to go back down there to Jerusalem to offer their sacrifices, and I'm just afraid their hearts are going to turn back to Rehoboam. Now, there was also something else he was specifically concerned about. It's a real personal matter, too. So he comes up with some ways, right, to try to keep everybody around, keep them from defecting over to. What false practices did Jeroboam establish? The golden calf. Let's talk about that for just a minute. Does that represent a complete departure from the one true God? It doesn't seem to be. And I'm basing this not only on what's said here, but what we will continue to read. I don't know that he's necessarily saying we're not going to have anything to do with Jehovah or with the Lord anymore. Because he does say these are the gods who brought us out of Egypt. I don't think they have, you know, forgotten who it was that brought them out. But regardless, I mean, God was not to be worshipped with graven images or carved images. I mean, if the law made anything clear, Ten Commandments make that clear, right? You just can't do it.
He should have remembered to put out the air. The people were
holding you up. Yeah, yeah. Well, and if you remember, I think Philip brought this out last night, even when that golden calf was built back in Exodus, that was the same statement. So he set up two golden calves at Dan. Now, when you talk about that northern kingdom of Israel, Dan would have been one of the northernmost cities, and Bethel would have been one of the southernmost cities. In fact, if you look on a map, Bethel is not too far above Jerusalem. So he set those two, so he's trying to, you know, put at least one of them pretty close to the people there. He made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. Remember, the law said they had to come from that tribe. Didn't matter what the law said or God said, at least to him. And he says he established a feast day, and the wording here is significant, right? Established a feast day which he devised in his own heart. Now, that's never a good idea. We have examples throughout Scripture of people who got in a whole heap of trouble or just coming up with a way to worship. Later on, we'll read about Jehoshaphat, one of the kings of Judah. And the very opposite will be said about him. I think it's in 2 Chronicles 17:6 says, "For Jehoshaphat took delight in the ways of the Lord." It's a big difference. Devising something in your own heart and then taking delight in the ways of the Lord. Again, that's about as opposite as it gets. All right, so anything else about chapter 12? Before we move on. As we move into chapter 13. So, if I understand the tie-in with the end of chapter 12 properly there, it seems like this takes place as he's there at Bethel to dedicate this shrine that's been built, this golden calf that's been set up. In fact, he's now at the altar and he's offering incense. You think he might have been startled just a bit? The prophet comes up, this prophet that comes from Judah to Bethel and starts crying out against Yahweh. That probably got him a little upset. Of course, we'll see in just a minute exactly what he did. How specific is this prophecy against the altar?
Name to name.
Name to name. Right. There in the middle of verse 2, behold a child, Josiah by name, shall be born to the house of David, and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and men's bones shall be burned on you. So, if I remember my history correctly, Josiah came about 10 or 15 years after that, right? I don't know exactly how far, but I will tell you this, we don't read about Josiah until about 2 Kings 23. And so he would have been toward the end of this 200-year period, right? So this is way, way off that this is going to happen. And yet the prophet names him by name. He's going to be the one who will bring this about. And so if y'all can hold off for just a little longer, when we get to 2 Kings 23, we'll finally see the fulfillment. Was Jeroboam provided anything to verify this prophecy, authenticate this as being from God?
It's
all for ruin. I mean, the prophet told him what was going to happen. It happened. The altar will be split, ashes will be poured out anywhere. Well, that's exactly what he did. But then what else was he provided? mean, you know, he's upset, of course, what the prophet's saying, you know, he says, arrest that man. You know, like to have his hand back. And so he entreats the man of God, you know, please, you know, pray the Lord in my hand. So you've got that actual sign about the altar, and then you've not only got the hand withering up, but then the hand also being restored. So there's no excuse for Jeroboam not to believe.
The Bible wouldn't make of it. It's quite a little interesting, at least in the King James Version. I think it says Jeroboam told the prophet,
yeah, but even then, he in the back of his mind, he knows he can rely on. I mean, later on, when he finds out, I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but when he finds out that his son is sick, he wants to find out from the Lord. Right? I mean, here he is, so unfaithful to the Lord, just showing flagrant disregard for the Lord's will, and yet when things get cut, let's go to the high, and let's find out the word of the Lord. No, exactly right. All right, so what offer, you know, Jeroboam, obviously his tune kind of changes a little bit toward this prophet now that he's restored his hand and everything. What offer did Jeroboam extend to this prophet, and what was his response? Yeah, come on back to the house with me, refresh yourself, I'll give you a reward. And the prophet's response was, and why was the prophet so emphatic about not going back to Jeroboam's house? Now, the Lord told him not to. Lord, in fact, the Lord was very specific about it. He said, don't eat any bread, don't drink any water. Don't even return the same way that you went. I don't want you to have anything to do with this devil place. You know? And so to the prophet's credit, he's obedient to the Lord. No. Lamar indicated a minute ago from the text, so far, so good, right? Prophet's looking good. He's courageously made this prophecy against the altar, against Jeroboam. He's been obedient to the Lord at this point. All right, though, but from whom else did he receive at least a similar offer? That old prophet, right? The sons had heard about, you know, what the prophet had said there in Bethel, and they told him, telling their father about it. He finds out and he saddles up a donkey. He goes over there and maybe intercepts the guy and finds him there by another tree. He says, come home with me. How's he working out? Eat bread, drink water, something of that nature anyway. Kind of along the same lines. And the prophet's response again is what? No, can't do it. The Lord has told me I can't do this. So that leads to the next question. How did the old prophet persuade him? Sorry, I'm a little bit deep. The Lord had been to him. Oh, he got that knowledge. You go ahead and be all about it. Yeah, yeah, verse 18, I too am a prophet as you are, and an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, bring him back with you to your house, that he may eat bread and drink water. And I love what the Holy Spirit tells us here, just in case we might be tempted to get the wrong idea here. He was lying to him. Okay. So we know this was under false. Now, as you read this passage, though, please tell me there's a New Testament passage that springs into your mind.
It's written in our book. Yeah.
Oh,
Galatians 1:8.
Oh, yes. Great. Yeah, if any man comes to you, or any angel comes to you and preaches any other gospel to you than what you have received, or what we have preached to you, let him be accursed. He had already received specific revelation from God. And look, we have the advantage now of knowing under the new covenant that all revelation has been given to us. So we know that anything that would go above and beyond that just can't be true. And so he's not quite in the same situation here, but could he have asked for some verification? I mean, here's a man that's already provided some signs for Jeroboam. He could have asked for a little bit more, you know, proof of, you know, the prophet speaking the truth here. And just the fact that this run was running completely counter to what God had said to him personally, that should have been a warning sign right there too. So you're tempted to feel a little bit sorry for the prophet here. But he should have known that. Should have known that. And we need to know that. We need to know that. What truth then did the old prophet reveal to him? This time he wasn't lying. What did he tell? That's a great news for him, isn't it? Not exactly right. Verse 21, starting there in the middle, because you have disobeyed the word of the Lord and not kept the commandment, which the Lord your God commands you, but you came back, ate bread, and drank water in the place in which the Lord said to you, eat no bread and drink no water, your corpse shall not come to the tomb of your fathers. Now there's nothing said in that about how quickly now, anything unusual about the prophet's death? I mean, I know people aren't necessarily killed by a lion every day, but I'm talking about especially after the lion killed. Anything unusual? Yeah, I would think, I don't have a lot of experience with lions, but I would think typically they finish the job. You know, once they kill you, I think they're going to go ahead and take care of the rest of the meat, so to speak. And they just hands over. Doesn't want the donkey. I mean, there's the donkey standing by the man. There's a lion standing over the man. And the lion just points. And people are going by and they're observing this, right? And of course, somebody sees it. They go back and tell the old prophet. Of course, he goes and gets the man's body, brings him back, and buries him in his tomb. All right, here at the end of this chapter, what did the old prophet say would surely come to pass? Earlier that the prophet had prophesied there when he went to Bethel. The old prophet says these things for sure come fast. True or false? With this great wake up call, Jeroboam turned back to God. You know? Kind of sad there at the end, verses 33 and 34 won't be all of that, but he did not turn from his evil way. And verse 34 even tells us that this will be what's behind the extermination of his house. It will be because of this. Now, we haven't really talked about this much, if at all. But one of the great lessons in this portion of history is the generational effect of sin. Now, as we keep studying here this year, the divided kingdom, there's going to be a whole lot of kings that are going to follow Jeroboam in the throne of Israel. Well, guess what phrase is used over and over and over again? Did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Israel. Or they followed after the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Israel. So here's Jeroboam doing these things, and this guy comes along and does the same thing. And finally, when we get to the end of the land of Israel, it says, and all Israel walked in the ways of Jeroboam. It wasn't just kings specifically themselves, all of Israel. And so if we get a bad thing rolling, it can keep on rolling on down through the years. Now, on the positive side, I prefer to think of this in a positive way about it. If we establish more of a legacy of righteousness, then what does that do? It tends to roll on through the generations to come. Right? So we need to think about how important it is for us to set that example. Think about this especially in relation to our children. Mark chapter 14. On what mission did Jeroboam send his wife?
Let's set this up for just a minute. What's happened there in Jeroboam's house that has a son? Yeah, a son is sick. All right, so, what mission does he send his wife?
I want the word of the Lord.
Yeah. God is.
But Jeroboam's concerned about something, though. And what is he concerned about? With his wife going on this mission.
See, if you reckon, we don't want anybody to know that you're
Jeroboam's wife, so he had to wear this disguise, right? So that nobody would know. How was her disguise? What was the condition of Ahijah at this time?
Poor eyesight.
Yeah, poor eyesight. His eyes were glazed over. I don't know if that means he had cataracts or what the deal was exactly. But he wasn't able to see very well, but the Lord took care of that. Jeroboam's wife is on the way. She'll be here in a moment. And boy, can you just try to put yourself in the shoes of, well, I guess Ahijah. Verse 6, and so it was when Ahijah heard the sound of her footsteps as she came through the door, he said, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another person?" So that's already kind of got to tremble a little bit, right? He said, "For I have been sent to you with bad news." Bad news. What bad news did Ahijah have? Or specifically, what's going to become of Jeroboam's house?
That's going to be destroyed.
Now, we'll have a few descendants of Jeroboam here, to reign, it's not going to be long before they will all be gone. So that's one part of the prophecy. And, of course, what's specifically going to happen to the son? I found this very interesting. In what way was Jeroboam's son an exception? What's said about the son in relation to the rest of Jeroboam's house? Verse 13.
That was something good for the Lord God of Israel. In him, his house was good.
I can't find much good. And I'm assuming this is a pretty young child here. The only good he could find was in this child. What does that tell us about the nature of children? That is confirmed elsewhere in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. What does it tell us? I think it's Deuteronomy 1 and verse 39 where I think it even distinguishes there between maybe babies and small children. I've forgotten the way it's worded. There's like two groups of young people discussed here. But the point that's made in that particular verse is they're unable to distinguish between good and evil. And again, that's just one of the many. These are just two of the many passages that we came against us. And so when somebody tells you that children are born depraved, they've inherited the sin of Adam and they're just helplessly enslaved in sin, don't believe that verse. There's nothing in the scripture to indicate that. In fact, it's opposite. All right. What would become of the nation of Israel? Ahijah has some prophecies that relate more to the immediate future, but he also kind of looks on. What's going to happen to Israel? Yeah, verse 15 specifically. Given to their fathers, they were scattered them beyond the river because reigned in Jeroboam's place after he died?
Yeah, son, yeah, right.
Now, I do want to give you a little bit of a heads up. I don't want you to think there's... I'm trying to make the way we go about this as least confusing as possible. Don't think we're through with Jeroboam in our Second Chronicles reading next week. We're actually going to kind of circle back and notice a few more things about Jeroboam. So even though we've talked about his death here, we'll talk a little bit more. We'll mention some other things about his reign, but the focus next week will be more on Rehoboam. We didn't have a whole lot to say about him tonight. And we'll get into some other kings as well. I had several practical lessons here. I think we covered most of them. Now, let me bring up one other in just a very little bit of time we have. Another thing that stands out to me as I study these kings is how appreciative I should be of our king. Of course, that is Jesus. I hear that talk about the yoke that Solomon put on the people, how heavy that yoke was. What does Jesus say in Matthew chapter 11, verse 30? My yoke is easy, and my burden is light. It's God's power. I think about how these kings, I mean, I think Solomon in particular, you know, not that there wasn't any concern for the people, but look, there was a lot of enriching of themselves. You know, behind all this, right? 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9.